are back again. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true right here in the 21st century. And we are glad that you are with us. I hope you join us every Sunday at 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. or Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And we also are streaming live this radio broadcast at those times. The podcasts are also available on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, and we are expanding that list as we speak. So please check it out. They're also available on the radio show's page of richarddugan.com. And if you like what we're doing, if it resonates with you and you'd like to support the work that we are endeavoring to bring forth and the people that we're bringing forth to you who have incredible information to share with you, we would love to have your support. If you would like, we would love to let you know that there is a PayPal link both on the homepage as well as the missions page of richarddugan.com, where you can click on that link, go to PayPal, and support us financially. We'll take energetic support too. Any amount is welcome, and the large or small doesn't matter. And again, we thank you in advance for that. And we also thank I guess you might say belatedly, although we've thanked them as we've gone, all those people in the last year and a half who have supported this program financially. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to see that notification pop up, or maybe an envelope in the mail pop up, and I read a little note from the person supporting us, and I send them an email saying, hey, thank you. Or I might even call them directly and say, I can't tell you how much your contribution has meant to this radio broadcast. So thank you, and thank you again. Today we're going to dive into an arena that is, I think it's interesting considering the world in which we live in today. We'll call it the rarefied air, and also we'll also talk to discuss from the perspective of where you're coming from, you as an individual, you as a worker, you somewhere, someplace, you are involved with other people, and you're just trying to make whatever it is that you're doing last. You want to make it sustainable. You want to make it not only competitive, but also provide to those who are receiving it, whatever it may be, product or service, the very best that it can be. And we're going to talk today about culture. No, we're not making yogurt. This is about cultural balance, the DNA of organizational excellence. And there's this wonderful little icon at the bottom of the book, a little diamond. I like that. And we'll talk about that as well with my guest, the author and business catalyst, Claudette Rowley. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks, Richard. I'm excited to be here. Thanks so much.
I know that as I was growing up, and again, I'm talking about even in my single digits, and as the whole concept of working, knowing that maybe in another 10 or 12 or 14 years, I'll be out there doing my thing. Didn't realize it was actually going to be sooner than that because at the age of, I think it was 11 or 12, I was a paper boy. Nah. And I loved that. You know, if that job were still available today in the way that it was back when I was a kid growing up, that would be the job I would give up radio for. Because you got to pretty much call your own hours. Mm-hmm. You met some incredible people. And I do that now with this program. I just don't have to say, hey, I'm here to collect for this week's subscription. Or I understand you don't subscribe. I'd like to get you to subscribe. We've got a great paper, great articles, blah, 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 blah. That was a great job. And I was out in the open air. And it was just, I would say, magical. It was great. Well, here I am doing this with you here on this particular program, talking about cultural balance. And I heard a statement made by some rather disgruntled Americans saying that they're real upset with the state of the culture today because their culture, as they deem it, is being lost. And I kind of wondered about how is it that your culture is being lost? Aren't you responsible for that? But you're talking about it more so, I think, from the business standpoint, and I don't think that people have ever thought of it from that standpoint, that there's actually, shall we say, a business or work culture. And of course, as it says here on the back cover of your book, in the 21st century, your company's success depends upon your ability to adapt to change. Now, that is a dirty word, Claudette. Change? Come on. We don't want to change. We want everything to be as it was in the 1950s, don't we?
Sometimes we think we do, but we actually really don't. And I just want to clarify, the book title is actually Cultural Brilliance, just so that if folks are interested and they want to find it, they know how to look for it. In the 1950s, you know, we sometimes think, oh yeah, things were so much better back then, but we actually have so many more opportunities for satisfaction and fulfillment now in our companies, in our organizations, in our personal lives. So I actually think, you know, looking at what's around us now is we actually have a lot more options and opportunities. And as you said at the beginning of the show, when you were opening it, this is about knowing we have choices. And I think in today's cultures, we have a lot more choices than we used to, certainly than we did in the 50s.
But a lot of people aren't buying into that. They might say it as a myth that we have choices, because they're arguing that a certain group of people, a certain organizations, certain governmental bodies, et cetera, are keeping them down, are preventing them from doing what they want to do. And I remember when I moved to California from Arizona and everybody was complaining about the regulations. There were two thoughts that came to mind. One was, as I began to learn about California regulations in particular, as well as federal regulations that impacted the state and its ability to do whatever it wants to do. Number one was the analogy I came up with was, the regulations are kind of, you're standing on a chessboard. Pick any square you want somewhere in the middle of the board. Okay, black or white, doesn't matter. The regulations basically are telling you, standing on one of those squares, you can't move forward, you can't move backward, you can't move left or right, nor can you go diagonally. And you can't stay where you are. And the other aspect of it was, if you really want to do what it is that you are, you feel like it's your life's purpose to do, whether it is start a small business or go to work for somebody else in a particular career, you then get creative and find ways, not exactly around the regulations, but maybe using them in some way to achieve what it is you want to do. Isn't that the essence of someone wanting to do something and they're hell-bent on doing it because they just have this drive inside, and yet they might see all of these different obstacles. And when they start it today, that doesn't mean it's going to be the way that it was day one on day 5062.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In addition to being the author of this book and doing a lot of work in organizational culture, I've also been a leadership coach and life coach for 20 years. So as you're talking about, you know, perspective and mindset, right, related to if I'm penned in by a regulation, what's a creative way that I can work with that regulation to get something done? And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing in cultures and in organizations and in individual people today, is when people start noticing that their mindset is actually what's trapping them or holding them back, they have a lot more options. If they think, oh, you know, yes, I have to deal with a regulation. Yes, I have to deal with a boss who's not as he or she should be. How can I work with this, work within this in a creative way to make this better for myself and better for other people? Or do I need to leave the situation entirely and go do something different? But the idea that we're not stuck, right? Being stuck is really, for most people, a construct. It's just a mindset.
Yeah. The other aspect of regulations, when people get all upset over how many there are, and I would agree that, yeah, I think in one sense they have gone a little over the line over the last maybe 20 or 30 years. But I always use this example when people are complaining about regulations and we need to get rid of them. I would bring up, okay, you have kids? Yeah, I have kids. Would you like your children at the age of 6 or 7 or 8 to be working? Well, no, of course not. He says, that's the reason why we have some regulations, because now we don't have children working in companies across this country, because businesses refused to do the right thing in regards to children. So these regulations, these laws were passed. Now, as I say, I think that we've kind of gone way beyond that whole concept now, and now it's, you know, darn near everything is regulated. But that doesn't mean that you can't accomplish what you want. And I think that as far as the cultural brilliance is something that I'm very curious about, especially with the subtitle, The DNA of Organizational Excellence. What do you mean by that? Because my understanding of DNA in the human perspective, the biological perspective, is it's just basically information. It's an information code that helps to build the person and the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual body that we happen to inhabit.
Yeah, absolutely. That is correct in my understanding as well. And so what's interesting about organizational culture, and I would say ethnic culture and almost every kind of culture we have, is that it is the holder of that information, right? So culture tends to be very historical, right? So it's something that happened, a decision that was made in an organization 5 years ago is usually still impacting the organization now, just as one example. So when I said the DNA of organizational excellence, that culture can actually create excellence in an organization, right? Because culture holds a ton of information, such as a set of beliefs about why we behave in certain ways in our company, a set of beliefs about why, what gets rewarded and what doesn't, how decisions get made, how conflicts are resolved, what leaders act like, what our values are, and all of those things, which are in part transmitted in conversation, but are also, as we know, transmitted in very unconscious ways in cultures, right? Just like in our families. I think of organizational culture, and I'll often align it with family culture to help people understand it, that no matter what you think about or how you felt about your family of origin, almost everybody knows exactly how they needed to behave and what was expected, whether it was spoken about or not.
Mm-hmm.
There was unspoken rules, right, in every family.
Mm-hmm.
And every organizational culture has unspoken rules too. So it becomes that DNA-like information that's driving you toward excellence or not toward, or mediocrity.
Yeah. And I would be certain that my current general manager would take the same tack as one of my earlier general managers who verbally stated this. I don't like surprises. So if there's something that's going on, you need to let me know so that if I get a phone call from someone saying, hey, what are you doing about this, that, and the other thing? I said, well, I have no clue what you're talking about. Let me research that. Mm-hmm. And I know that my present boss has never actually said that, but I've kept that in the back of my mind going, let's not have him be surprised. If I got a phone call from a disgruntled listener or programmer or advertiser, I would immediately say, okay, thank you, and I'll certainly pass that on. And then I call him immediately or go into his office and say, hey, so-and-so called, and here's the complaint, blah, 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 so that when he gets that phone call, he's up to speed. He does not like being surprised. And I think that that's probably the case in most businesses. There are a couple of philosophies that I've lived by in my career, and I think they apply here. But actually, I want to go in a little different direction for just a moment, and that has to do with this aspect of change. Would you say that companies in this country in particular that are closing their doors, for example, the most recent story is that there's one company that is literally shutting all, I think it's 22,000 stores in America, Payless, Shoe Source. Do you think that the reason that they're shutting their doors across the country, and I don't know how many people they're going to be laying off, is because they didn't adapt and change with the times? Or is it just the times in which we live just wouldn't allow a company like this to continue?
It's a really interesting question, and I don't know the details of the Payless situation, but speaking generally, when we look at like the Blockbuster, right? Blockbuster versus Netflix usually brought up as a really interesting case study in just what you're saying. Like what happens when an organization doesn't keep up with the times or some, in some cases, the corporation hasn't attended to its own culture very well. And I don't know if that's the case with Payless or not, but it hasn't attended to its own culture very well. And what's happened over time is people are less productive. They're less engaged. And we know that hits the bottom line after a while. And so you end up seeing this organizational system, so to speak, that literally cannot function well. And then when you add into that, external threats, rapidly changing times, politics and everything else that goes into running a company in this day and age, regulations, then you can end up with a company that very quickly starts to sink. So culture really, I think culture matters now more than it ever has in terms of a company's ability to stay, not only stay afloat, but to succeed and stay relevant.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. And I want you to help me out to understand this because, I know that a lot of us, regardless of where we fall on the political spectrum, and this is not a political question, mind you, because this question could be asked at any point along the timeline going back to from the time I was born in 1960 and to the present. A government is not a business, and a business is not a government. And yet we keep hearing from different candidates down through the decades that this has to be done and that has to be done and so forth. Is that a fair assessment that a government isn't a business? You cannot run a government like a business and vice versa, that there are a whole different set of rules, or, using your word here, so to speak, it's a whole different culture and you can't go in there with the same rules. They don't apply.
I would agree with you on that. I think governments and businesses are two different, certainly two different cultures. Mm-hmm. They work in very different ways. I think there are certainly aspects sometimes of business. Business, as we know, tends to be a front runner, right? Often. Mm-hmm. And new ideas, new philosophies, new ways of learning, new ways of leadership. So can government take some of those ideas that are applicable and be successful with them? Sure. But a government doesn't exist for the same reasons a business exists. And I think you need to look at them separately and individually in terms of what their goals are, their missions are, what they're there to accomplish. And then really from there, what's the best culture that's going to support achieving those objectives, whether that's a business or a government?
I want to ask you in reference to, say, restaurants. Now, we've had a number of restaurant-focused programs on this particular station, and I'm sure they're all over the country. And the one question that they love to bring up, especially people who've owned restaurants, they'll ask someone who wants to start one, they'll say, what's the reason why you want to do this? And they will give them their answer. Well, because there's this cuisine that I would love to work on and I would love to present to the public, blah, blah, blah. There's this environment that I would love to encourage people to come to and be a part of as we serve them the various menu items. And invariably, the response back from the questioner is wrong. That is not the reason you go into business to open a restaurant. The only answer to that question is to make money. It has been said that capitalism's flaw is greed, that wasn't calculated into the process. Can you help us to understand and better put into context the reasons why I would want to open a small business and so forth? Because, and I'm only guessing here because I haven't done the research on this, the immigrants who came into this country through Ellis Island back in the late part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, they came here for a better life. They came here because of the phrase land of opportunity, and they took advantage of that. And now some of those people or their families are reaping the rewards of multi-billion dollar corporations that didn't exist 100 years ago. And their motive was not just to make money. Can you talk to us about the dichotomy as I see it, I don't know if it's a catch-22, in that reference to the way people look at free enterprise and the capitalist system as far as this whole aspect of cultural brilliance?
Absolutely. And I think... You know, businesses exist to make money, absolutely. But as you were saying, the really successful businesses, the businesses that have an impact on us, and I believe businesses do have a huge impact on society, not just in the products they produce and the bottom line, but also, and they provide jobs and there are many other benefits, but they also are huge potential contributors to society. And they help shift our larger organizational culture in negative ways or positive ways. So, you know, think about what Walmart has provided for certain communities, right? A place where people can shop that's economical, a place for people to work, right? If Walmart had a different paradigm, a different way of doing business, they would have a different impact on communities. So, and we can think of lots of examples of, you know, negative examples of ways businesses have impacted communities. But I think, you know, to this interesting story about, being a restaurateur, and I want to try this kind of cuisine and I want to be in this community and hearing the feedback. No, no, no. The only reason is to make money. Making money is really important. But what I do know also is that if you're thinking of starting a business, you've got to be completely passionate about it or you won't make it, because it's so hard to start a business and keep it going, especially those first 5 years. And I know the restaurant business in particular is challenging. So people need to make money and they need to figure out how they're going to do that to survive. But they also need to understand why they're doing something, the larger contribution they're making to their community, their neighborhood, and their society, and how they can really be a force for good in the community. And I think in 2019, those are actually the reasons to start a business and maintain one. And I think that's changing. We're slowly starting to see people look at business as a potential force for good. And that's something I do talk about a little bit in the book, is how if we can change the culture of business, we can change the culture of our society. I think business has a huge potential to do that.
And yet, when most people think of business and corporations, they have a sour taste in their mouths because of a lot of the problems that we have seen with some of the greed and corruption, and then in the car industry, recalls. I'm flabbergasted every time I hear about recalls. Going, you're going back 7 years? How is it that you didn't know that this part had a problem 2 years ago, or 3 or 4 or 5 years ago? You waited 7? And of course, then somebody explained to me, said, well, sometimes it takes that long for the part to wear down to the point where they realize, oh, we have a problem. And I'm thinking, don't they do R&D? these kinds of things. But this is where a lot of people, they really have a problem with a lot of the bigger businesses that in some instances they kind of come into communities and they're accused of shoving out the small businesses, the mom and pops and so forth. You know, I know that Walmart was accused of that. I mean, I'm sure many of the bigger corporations that have moved into different areas, have they been accused of that? Does, in order for a small business to thrive in that kind of an environment, that's one of those instances where they have to adapt and change, don't they? They have to find or sort of reinvent themselves, right? Or is that even possible? Yep. When you get someone who's got the big bucks and the big corporation, and you might as well throw up your hands and say, I can't compete because they're just too big.
I think it's such a, It sometimes that's true. And then I think there are also, as you were saying, there's also an opportunity to adapt. And a lot of it, you know, when we look at culture itself, organizational culture itself, you know, when we want to change it, we first have to really understand it. And so if you're looking for your niche, so to speak, you're looking for your foothold, you're looking for how you need to adapt to draw in a certain kind of customer audience, mm-hmm. You do need to do some assessing. You do need to understand the environment and the culture in which you're working. And to your earlier point about business or corporations being viewed negatively, absolutely, there are still corporations that are doing things environmentally and in other ways that Wells Fargo in the last few years, they're violating, I mean, sometimes laws, but they're also just violating integrity and ethics and a sense of morality. Absolutely. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we see companies that are doing really amazing things, you know, the B Corporation. So what I see right now is a hugely wide spectrum, everything from businesses who are contributors to businesses who are breaking laws. And we see everything in between.
Yeah. And I think that's where people really become disenfranchised, not from a business standpoint, with the whole process. And I have to say that when organic foods sort of started hitting the markets, maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15, maybe 20 years ago. And I couldn't jump on the bandwagon in spite of what people were telling me about the difference between organic and non-organic foods. I said, yeah, but see, you can slap a label on anything and call it whatever you want. What is the old political line? You know, you can put lipstick on a pig and it's still a pig.
Right.
And I still make that same argument. As a matter of fact, that was borne out in a situation where here in California, I believe it was, there was a farm that was selling organic strawberries that weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were called on it. And I don't know if there were fines. I don't know what the penalties were. But that's one of the things that's so disturbing to me. I've had one instance that I can recall in my career where I had a production project that I was asked to do, and this was back in the late 90s. And the woman came to me and says, this is what I want to do, and this is how I want it done, and so on. And she was basically telling me how to do my job. But I thought, hey, she's the customer, you know, she's always right. And so I did it exactly the way she wanted it done. And I gave her the tapes. Back then, that's what we were using. Mm-hmm. I can't use these. This is terrible. And I'm sitting here. I wanted to say, but this is exactly what you asked for. And I said, look, I cannot refund your money because I don't have it. And it was a pretty good size financial project. I says, but what I will do is I'll make it good. I says, let's call everybody back in. We'll re-record everything. And then here's how we're going to do this. And we came back. We redid it. I gave her the tapes again. Loved it. Came back for two more projects after that. Okay. Mm-hmm. What's gone awry in our business culture, if you will, because you mentioned two or three elements, you know, of ethics and morals, you know, just doing the right thing. I was asking this of somebody the other day in reference to doing the right thing. And I'm seeing people constantly here in the Santa Barbara area on foot walking against the red light. They don't care. Oh, there are no cars coming. Would you do that in your car? Oh, no, I'd get a ticket. You can get a ticket walking against a red light, too. That's doing the right thing. And if nobody was around you, would you still do the right thing? And what mm-hmm. we see in a lot of instances is that this attitude of doing the right thing is like disappearing from our businesses, even from our various institutions, religious, educational, I'll say medical, and so on and so, you know, and you know, I'm sure that we could sit here and list all of the areas, but can you give us an idea as to why you think this is starting to somehow phase out, or are you actually seeing it starting to phase back in again?
I see it starting to phase back in again. And I know exactly what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. The customer service representatives that don't care, right? People walking against the red light. We, like you said, mm-hmm. we could go on and on.
I work for the DMV. I don't care.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so absolutely. And what I see, though, I see examples of it phasing back in. It feels to me like it, in my observation, has been that in some cases it's gone so far in the wrong direction, it's actually starting to boomerang back. As people have realized, like, wow, we're actually going to lose business. Like, this is going to hit and this is when we see change in business usually, right? It hits the bottom line negatively. And mm-hmm. they start recognizing it's because of certain decisions they've made in terms of how, with their employees or their customers, right? Usually people related, operational related. And then they start looking at what they need to do better and differently. I'm starting to see that boomerang back, you know, very slowly, of course, in positive ways. We are seeing more people starting to do the right thing. And I think part of what we've seen nationally, at least, you know, certainly speaking only of the US, is the Me Too movement. People, Wells Fargo, Uber, Papa John, you see people and leaders being called on the carpet that would not have been called on the carpet before for behavior. And I think that has allowed and really called attention to people that, you know, certain kinds of integrity and morals and ethics really can't be violated. There's a standard we have to maintain. And your definition of integrity you mentioned is one that I use also, which is it's doing the right thing when no one's watching you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No one's paying attention. No one's listening to you or watching you. What would you do?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of integrity you need to reinstall.
Yeah. I was talking with a former police officer not too long ago, and I asked him basically, and I put this to a lot of people. I said, okay, just because I know this is very flat land out in this particular area of the country, if you are out in the middle of Nebraska at 2 a.m. and you came upon a four-way stop, four stop signs, would you stop? The land's flat. You don't see headlights coming from the other directions. Would you stop? Mm-hmm. Most people tell me no. And I'd say, why not? It's just because there were no other cars coming. I said, but that's not the rule under which we live. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to stop at red lights. We're supposed to stop at stop signs. We're supposed to, I was trying to get into a roundabout here. We have a few here in the central, on the central coast. And I started getting honked at. But there's a sign that says yield, and there were other cars coming across my path in the roundabout. I'm not going to enter the roundabout unless I've got a clear shot. But people behind me were just, they were just ticked off because I wasn't going straight in, you know. And that's part of the reason why my blood pressure, I have to deal with blood pressure medication now. But I'm getting better at that because I realize that it's not personal, which is, no. is a double-edged sword. It's like, okay, I'm glad it's not personal. What do you mean? It's not, you don't care enough about me as a person to make it personal. This is interesting stuff. And Claudette, I want to continue our conversation here. Cultural brilliance, the DNA of organizational excellence. And we're going to take a look at some other areas as well. How about uncovering how your cultural system currently operates and identify your target, brilliant culture? How about co-design the solutions with participation from all organizational levels? Boy, I tell you, from my standpoint as a person who's been, I guess you'd say, in middle management, and regardless of being in that position, I've always still done the same job that everybody else does. I sit behind the console and I push the levers back and forth and push the buttons and cue up the tapes and the reels and the CDs and the audio files and so forth. And I've always taken the position I want to share everything I know with everybody that I can so that I can move on to other things. But there's so much territorialism within companies these days. We'll also talk a little bit more too, Claudette, about how to develop action plans that install new mindsets, behaviors, and structures, as well as make listening. Oh, come on. No. I don't need to listen. I have all the answers. Trust, truth, truth-telling. Ooh, truth-telling and essential part of your organization. We're talking with Claudette Rowley, and it's cultural brilliance. And the website, I'm going to guess, is either a cultural brilliance or Claudette Rowley. Is that correct?
It's culturalbrilliance.com.
All right. We're going to be linked to that as well. We're going to continue our conversation with Claudette here on Tell Me Your Story. I would ask you to stay with us, please.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
It's Cultural Brilliance, the DNA of organizational excellence, with my special guest. She is a business catalyst. I like that. I like that moniker, Claudette. Claudette Rowley is my guest. Culturalbrilliance.com is the website. We will be linked to it as well. Okay, so let's jump into this aspect of it. What's a brilliant a business catalyst?
What's a business catalyst? Thanks for asking. Yeah, so you know, when I've looked back over my career, and I've had my own business for about 20 years. And even before that, I was always good at catalyzing things, you know, whether it was people to get motivated, to get new ideas going in an organization, you know, when I was an employee, to design new programs or processes, and then as a consultant to really catalyze people to move forward in new and different ways. And so, you know, it was something that we wanted to put a label or a title on the book cover, came up with Business Catalyst. It's I love being a catalyst. I love catalyzing change.
You know, the concept, as I understand the definition, at least rudimentary in any way, has to do with something that ignites. It's almost not inflammatory in the derogatory context, but inflammatory right. in the heat and fire, combustible right. context. And I often ask, so as a business catalyst, I'm going to use the word again in my question. What was the catalyst that drove you into this arena, that propelled you into wanting to help these? And now you deal with Fortune 1000 businesses, but obviously others as well, small businesses and alike, and institutions and what have you. What was it? Yeah. What was the, you know, something in your childhood, or was it something someone said? They say you, it just kind of resonated with you and off you went.
Well, in my 20s, I had two jobs, and when I looked back, they were actually the catalyst. So my first job was, I was a social worker, and I worked for the state of Idaho. And I was in Family and Children's Services. And interestingly, you know, state government often has a reputation for not having a great culture. But this particular office I worked in did. And I had a great manager. And he said, you know, I see a lot of potential in you in these particular ways. I'd like you to design a program for us. Here are your parameters. As long as you stay inside these parameters, you can do whatever you want. So I was given a lot of autonomy, creativity. I was trusted and respected. And it was one of the best jobs, a very transformational job I ever had. And then I moved across the country to the Boston area where I still live. And I got a job at a nonprofit, because I, again, was in social work. And it was a large nonprofit. It did, I think it still exists, doing a lot of good work in the world externally. But the culture internally was toxic. And I was in my 20s, so I didn't really know anything about culture, and I didn't know what to look for yet and things like that. And what I noticed, you know, I did good work there. I had a pretty good job. I contributed. I created another program. But I noticed how my confidence slipped because of the kind of culture. I was in a culture where people were backstabbing each other, and it was highly political, and you needed to really watch out for yourself. And people got in the in-group and the out-group, and it was really challenging to navigate, and especially when you're in your late 20s. And I noticed how my confidence slipped, and I got really, really interested in leadership, and I got really interested in how you could be in one organization and feel confident, and you could be in another and not feel confident. And looking back, that was really the catalyst for a lot of things I did after that, was understanding how we could make organizations develop and evolve so that people really did great work in them and felt supported.
Hmm. Well, I have never had that happen in my career. Never had a hostile work environment. It's never. It's interesting when you talk about that, because that's exactly what happened to me back in the late 90s. And I was in my, I guess I was in my late 30s. That's right. And I was working in a very hostile work environment. I probably could have filed suit. I probably would have won and so on. But it's like, you know, they say pick your fights, you know, and I didn't want to go down that road. But I also didn't want to give the guy that was making it a hostile work environment the satisfaction of quitting. So I hung it out. And eventually they laid me off and gave me a massive severance package, which, of course, told me that I did nothing wrong and they were doing something wrong. Because in broadcasting, unless you have a contract, you don't get severance packages, okay? And then I found the next place that I went to work was like, it was like the family. They said, oh, we know you've been through, come in, let us embrace you and take you in. And it was the most incredible 2 months. And I stayed there for much longer than that, but it was that first 2 months that was just, it was fabulous. I mean, it was like I'd come home. And so it was like, what a contrast between the two. So there are some companies and some people that are out there that really want to help you to succeed. Where do you start with a company? Let's just say, for example, Wells Fargo came to you today. All right. We know, as far as the news stories, what has been happening with them. It almost seems like every week it's a new one, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they came to you and said, look, you know, we've been screwing up. We admit that. Okay. That's on us. All right. We've been making some serious mistakes, and we're really lucky to still be in business, but we really need to, clean up our act, and we need to fix the culture in this company.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you start with and I'm going to phrase it this way, a company like that?
Well, it's like that, right? Yeah. So it's interesting. The starting point for almost all companies is pretty similar. What happens after that is, of course, different, but depending on the organization. I mean, you've got to start with a full assessment of the culture. And the key to all of this is the leaders, even though, as you mentioned, in the way that I work with companies, it involves participation from people at all different levels and departments and teams. But you've got, the leadership has to be 100% on board and committed to this work. Otherwise, you know, because they influence the culture heavily, and you can't start, you know, shifting the culture of middle management and then have them hit a ceiling where the leadership says, no way, we're not changing anything. So a company like that, leaders on board, the board of directors on board with what we want to do, and then really design, and especially with a company that large, in a process of assessing the culture so that everyone starts to understand and actually really co-create an understanding, co-design, an understanding of this. These are the norms of behavior here. These are the beliefs, and really start to get These are the good parts of our culture that we want to keep. And these are the things that have held us back. These are the behaviors and beliefs that have actually caused us to behave in ways that were not so good in the Wells Fargo case situation. And you start to understand what you want to keep and what you want to let go of. And they start to really get, oh, okay, based on all this assessment work and deep understanding of our culture, this is the kind of culture we really need to have to transform our company.
Hmm.
And that's the starting point, is that deep understanding.
All right. Say you've got a CEO, let's say, or the head of the company. Maybe it's not a huge company with maybe less than 25 people. And this guy or gal started this from ground zero in their garage or something, and now it's progressed. They're in a high rise. Maybe they're in a 2 or 3 story building, and maybe, I don't know, we may have a warehouse and this and that and the other. But they're not as successful as they like to be. And certainly the draw to go in, so to speak, the wrong direction is there, because obviously there are people out there who are more than willing and able to draw you in and say, hey, you know, I can make you successful in 6 months and you're going to have 7-figure profits and so on and so on and so on. And then you've got the person who started it saying, well, but Claudette, this is my company, and this is the way we've always done it, and I don't want to. I started this, Claudette. Mm-hmm. I don't want to change this. How do you deal with some of that kind of resistance, or is that already set aside because of the fact that they're coming to you?
It depends. That's a really important distinction. Some of it may be set aside, but when we get in, as we know, people don't know what they don't know. So as we get into a conversation about the culture, especially with the founder, right, who has such a commitment to doing things in a certain way usually, and they may start resisting, he or she, because it's like you, for the very reason you said, like, whoa, we've always done it this way. I created this. This is the, you know, but what I do is it's really, it's leading people through the thought process. Okay, so you've been doing it this way and that worked really well for the first 3 years of your business and you got these results. But when you continue doing it this way for, you know, years 4, 5, and 6, your results weren't as good. So it's having people start to see that what worked at one point no longer works and they're not getting the outcomes they need. And what I find is often when I, you know, walk people through that process in a logical way, they'll start to say, oh, okay, I kind of see what you're saying. This is hard for me, but I have a better understanding of this now. The founder of a company, like you, as you just described, I mean, that person had to be 110% committed and passionate to even start it and continue it and put their blood, sweat, and tears into it. So it makes so much sense they're emotionally connected to how they ran it, and that they have to then say, I actually need to shift this now and change it. And that can just be really hard. But with some support and a lot of conversations, I found that most people will shift over because they start to see they can get something better done with a change.
When Steve Jobs died, my first thought was that initially Apple was going to have a decline, because mm-hmm. who had the vision? Steve did. That was his vision. And unless right. he was able to instill that vision in the next level of people, shall we say, below him or alongside, however you want to look at that. The company wasn't going to go anywhere after that. And the same thing with Bill Gates and Microsoft. If he didn't instill the same kind of vision, and that's difficult to do because every individual has their own vision of things. You know, all we have to do is look at presidents down through the history of our country, and each one of them has a different vision and goes in and does what he wants, and the next guy comes in and undoes what he did and does his own vision version of right. America, and then the third guy and the fourth guy, and it's like, I'm not getting anywhere, you know?
Right.
And in business, it's the same way, isn't it?
It can be. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on the kind of leader that comes in.
Mm.
So there might be a leader who comes in as after, you know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, or someone like that, and says, okay, what do we need to do to really sustain this vision? Or maybe a new vision is needed. You know, there are some leaders I've seen that will come in with that really thoughtful ability to analyze the situation, to listen, and to really find out what's best for the company, versus what's going to make them look good as a leader. Because those are not always the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes you just assume your ego or putting your mark on something to help sustain or build something. And I think with with someone like a Steve Jobs, or not him specifically, but a really high visionary like that who's been transformational in the world, sometimes they're so visionary and they're so intense in how they want things done. Sometimes when they leave the organization, it actually gives it the freedom to try some new things that might be equally successful. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that because, obviously the people that work for a particular company below the CEO, the founder, et cetera, they would like to keep their jobs.
Yeah.
And so they are hopefully going to find some ways of doing that. A matter of fact, I remember seeing a story of this one guy who came here from, and I wish I could remember the country he came from, and he was making this yogurt. And it's great stuff, but he needed a place to make it. And he found this, I'm trying to remember all the details here, I'll do the best I can. Anyway, he found this small town and this big old factory that was shut down because that particular company had left. He bought the building and he opened up his plant and he started his new business, with this new yogurt that he was making. And the biggest difference in his model than a lot of other companies is he made every single employee who came into the plant, who came to work for him, so to speak, co-owners of the company. Mm-hmm. So they had a vested interest in that. Is that good motivation for keeping people employed? And maybe we can talk a little bit about that in the context of the 21st century, because my dad worked for the same company for maybe, 20, 30 years before they wanted to move the plant to another state and he didn't want to move the family. He left that company and so forth. And yet there are some families that, my dad did this and my grandfather did this and my great grandfather did this. And this is the family business. And it's not that they own it or founded it. That's where they've worked, the steel mills and the coal mines and the factories and so forth. And I'm wondering if that particular perspective has changed, or is this new model of embracing employees as, so to speak, co-owners of a company can help to foster a more productive and a more healthy culture in a business?
I think it does. And I talk a lot about ownership in my, not specifically in the book, but with some of my current clients. Mm-hmm. And not, like you said, not necessarily that they're legal owners or financial owners, mm-hmm. but what is it like for them to have a high degree of ownership? And in order for that to happen, the company has to give them a lot of empowerment, right? Autonomy. The ability to solve problems. So you can't tell people to be an owner and not give them any authority, right? It doesn't work.
Yeah.
This is going to make them frustrated. But it's a really, it's a very interesting model for the 21st century, because a lot of people want to use their best strengths and talents. They want to create things, and they don't, especially, the younger generations, people in their 20s and 30s, they don't necessarily want to work in that same model of, I worked for the same company for 20 or 30 years and just wanted to hold on to my job. It's people have different, are having actually higher expectations now for their work lives. And they want to work in great cultures and have different experiences.
What about an individual's, as we like to talk on many occasions on this program, an individual's life purpose?
Mm-hmm.
I use the example of, down through the generations, this is what our family has done.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you come across someone who doesn't want to do that. I know that was what Dad did, and I know that was what Gramps and Great-Grandpa did, and so on and so on and so on. But that's not what I want to do. And, of course, there's a lot of heat within the family. They said, you're abandoning the family business, so to speak, okay? It's mm-hmm. not necessarily, again, not owned by them, but it's just what that family has always done.
Right.
When we hit the 2009, I guess they call it the Great Recession, mm-hmm. and thousands upon thousands of people lost their jobs, right?
Right.
One of the first thoughts that came to my mind was, I wonder how many of those people hated their jobs.
Yeah.
How important, from your perspective, in terms of fostering the kind of business culture, since that's the word we're using here. How does one do that, and at the same time, you know, help to foster that in the company or organization? Because sometimes it may not be a company. Maybe it's a nonprofit. You know, they want to work as a social worker in this particular area, what have you. Talk to us a little bit about that and that aspect of it in terms of one's life's purpose.
Yeah, I think, you know, life purpose is sometimes people that really matters to people. Sometimes people spend, I've seen people spend an enormous amount of time and money, you know, working with coaches and other people to help them find their life purpose. Some people certainly know it. Like you said, they may be born into something. Mm-hmm. But where I see it is in an organization, when I talk about this idea of brilliance, right, I'm talking about not only bringing out the best in having a culture that brings out the best in people, but it also brings out the positivity and the innovation, the invention. Like I've seen the light come back on in people's eyes.
Oh yeah.
You know, in an organization where they looked kind of sometimes just totally disengaged and flat to varying degrees. So there's a way in which an organization can give someone an opportunity, really, to work in their life's purpose. There's a lot of movement in the culture movement around how do we, you know, strengths-based leadership. How do we create cultures of feedback so people can grow and develop? This idea that having people grow and develop is a business strategy. So we see at the fringes of sort of in the middle of how people are talking about culture and what we see in books about culture. There's a lot around developing people, but then it's sort of at the fringes of the business world. It's an idea that's really starting to percolate more and more and more, that this isn't just come to work, put your head down and do your job, that there's something more here that benefits not only individual people and their life's purpose, but it will benefit the entire company.
How about the balancing that with your home life? You know, you have a family, even if it's just you and your spouse or partner. Maybe you don't have kids and so forth, because I know I've run into this where I love what I do and I would spend the majority of my time here doing this, talking with you and other guests about all of the wonderful ideas and concepts that they have. Not that I don't like being at home. I do. We spent this past weekend, for example, with the rain and a little bit of wind and so forth, but the cold temperatures loved. Got a fire going in the fireplace. We're watching a little Netflix, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe made a big old cup of hot cocoa with little Baileys in it, just enjoying being up there on the hill. We live in the rural area of Santa Barbara County and just above the city, and just really liking it. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, if I have to schedule something for, you know, 5 o'clock in the evening on a Saturday, you know, because it's the only time that guest is available. I really like to get this guest. Usually my wife will acquiesce and say, okay, sure, go for it, you know, and I'll come down and do it and blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to set up at home so I don't have to leave the house. But what about that juxtaposition? Do you work with individuals who, you know, they've found their life's purpose and so forth? Do they have to make some of the hard choices as to whether or not, do I really, you know, how important is my life's purpose to my life partner, if you will, mm-hmm. or home life or what have you, or downtime away from kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially when I was doing a lot of coaching, that came up quite a bit, where people were my experience has been that most life purposes require us to make choices, like you said, some hard choices.
Yeah.
And decide how do I navigate it? How will this, my life purpose requires me to live in a certain part of the country, let's say. How does that impact my partner or my home life? If my life purpose requires me to go back to school and get, you know, an advanced degree, right, et cetera. So it's I find the people that have been most successful with it are willing to have those really challenge, sometimes, not always, but sometimes really challenging conversations with the people in their life. Because if you give up on if you find your life purpose and you know it's true for you and you can feel it, right? You can feel it in your heart and soul that it's the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you choose to not do it. Part of you is always a little dead. And So I think it's important to navigate that with the rest of your life as best as you can. And maybe you delay it for a few years. Maybe you just do part of it. There's always compromise and choice within it. Mm-hmm. There's a spectrum.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to keep advancing toward that life purpose, just so you as a human being can be your best self and feel fulfilled.
Maybe that's also where that whole creativity has to come into play to figure out how to have both.
Right.
We've all heard the phrase, you know, you can have it all. And then you sit there going, no, I can't really have it all. To coin a phrase from Stephen Wright, the comedian, if you had it all, where would you put it? But it's still possible that you can have those things that you want in your life. But are you willing to do the creative work to find those opportunities to make that happen in order to do that? When I received a copy of your book, the press release page was stuffed into the book at a particular point. Now, I'm a type of a person, I don't believe in coincidence. I believe in coincidence. And so that page was stuffed between pages 58 and 59. And on 58, the heading down at the bottom of the page is the energy of listening. And then in the mid portion of page 59, it was the energy of mindset. Talk to us first about this concept of energy in cultural brilliance.
So energy, and I don't believe in coincidences either. So I'm glad you noted the page numbers there. So the energy, we know we're made of energy. What people don't think a lot about usually is that every organizational system you're in, your family, your community group, your club, any kind of organization, right? Including your business or your job, every organization, every system has energy in it. And that we sense that when we go in, you know, you go into a company or a place of worship, any sort of entity, and you say, wow, it's just so uplifting in here. I don't even know why, but it's really positive. That's energy. Or you go in and have the opposite. I was in there for only 15 minutes, but I now feel kind of down. I'm tired. I don't even know why. That's energy. It's a different, you know, that's an environment where we're going to guess if it's really low energy, that the culture is not that great, or something really challenging has just happened or whatever. But we have collective energy. We also interestingly have collective mindset, in the sense that research has actually shown that mindsets are contagious. That's why when you have one negative person on a team, you run the risk of really hurting the team.
Yeah.
Even though you might have, you know, one negative person and five positive people, but that negative person can have an impact. So those are some examples of energy as it relates to businesses and organizations.
What about individual perspectives like that? Five optimistic and one pessimistic individual. How do you maintain, shall we say, an up energy, a positive energy? You walk out of that room and he's feeling good. And at the same time, allow the pessimist to have his say without bringing the energy down.
It can be a challenge. Of course, it depends on what the pessimist is saying, but
yeah, sure.
It can be a challenge. I mean, I think if you're really speaking of the energy of listening, right?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned from the book, if you're really in that perspective, energy of listening closely to what the person has to say, and you have maybe some compassion for where they're coming from, and you can have an important or productive conversation with them, that can lift the energy back up. It can sometimes, I've been in situations where I sat down with someone and said, are you aware that you're having a particular kind of impact on the rest of the group? They may not know.
Well, you are.
That can shift things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about this neat little symbol at the bottom of the book, the diamond. What's the meaning there for you?
Yeah, diamonds, right, are brilliant. And so I like this idea of the diamond. You know, it's multifaceted, just like culture. It has brilliance to it. Diamonds are also viewed as very, you know, they're positive. They have light, right? They are a symbol of wealth. And I don't just mean financial. It can be any, you know, spiritual, emotional, right? People, any kind of wealth, productivity, innovation. So to me, it's all of those things. It's really about reflecting the light of the culture in a positive way.
Where is the best place for a cultural brilliance to start? Because when you get to the business, it's to me, it seems a little late. Now, that's not to say that, again, the work that you do, you try to help companies and corporations and businesses, large and small, to cultivate, again, this cultural brilliance. But where should this begin to be fostered? How early on, and are there techniques or ways that we can do that to our future our future workers?
Yeah, you know, a colleague of mine is really passionate about including classes on culture, you know, in at the university level, and I think it's something to even teach a high school, you know, a high school student about what organizational or any kind of culture, right, is. I mean, any organizational culture works as a phrase because we're all in different kinds of organizations, not just businesses. But what organizational culture is, what's it like, you know, for them to be in one? How do they know if it's a positive one or one that's not so positive? For them to even understand it exists and what it's all about would change a lot of the choices people make when they enter the workforce, as most people do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important.
I know that people, they will get into a job, but they'll end up working in a cubicle and it'll drive them absolutely bonkers. And it's like, what am I doing here? I don't, this is not where I want to be. And who knows, maybe the next thing you know, as the current 21st century term goes, they ghost the company.
They just
disappear.
Right.
You know, and which is really interesting. I mean, I have heard of people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s even, just in recent days, literally in recent days, who had been working for a company for like 30, 35, 40 years. And all of the sudden, supposedly all of the sudden, they got fed up. And where's Janet? And Janet just walked out without saying a word to anybody. She was done. She'd had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the term ghost employee, I guess is the phrase, has become part of the nomenclature, part of the lexicon, because that's what's happening. You know, you'll get somebody, I don't know if they're millennials, I don't know what, you know, age bracket they're in, but you know, they may only be there for a day or two or three, and then I realize this isn't what I want to do, bye bye, and they don't come back after lunch or whatever. Does that seem to be a problem these days for companies in terms of hires? Because I know that it's expensive. It can get very expensive to hire new people and train them before they become a productive part of the company.
I have seen it, and the thing that I find disturbing about it is this whole idea of ghosting. Because to me, it's this loss of communication, right? Like, where's the integrity? As we were talking about integrity earlier, to have enough integrity to say, this isn't, you know what? This isn't working for me. I'm really sorry for the inconvenience, right? I need to give my 2 weeks notice.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I think when we see people, when we know it has to do with our cell phones and social media, et cetera, and the way people communicate, but when we see people think it's just okay to not communicate, even when it's a hard conversation, that like it lacks integrity, it lacks courage, it lacks a lot of the things that we want to see reinstalled right back into our larger society, like integrity and courage, and just human decency. Like, you don't just walk out without saying anything.
Yeah.
You have to talk.
By the way, what is the standard notice we should be giving? Because I quit one job and I gave them a month. And after the second week, I'm going, why did I do that? I was trying to be really, really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the standard's still 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The companies that I'm consulting for, that is what I hear. It's 2 weeks, and certainly longer if you can, or if it makes sense, or it's important to. And I think I know the last job I had as an employee, which was 20 years ago, but I also gave a month's notice, you know, because I had a lot I wanted to close out, and I'd worked with a lot of clients I needed to say goodbye to. So I think at least the 2 weeks is standard.
Yeah. It's very interesting, the world in which we live, as far as the business aspect and as well as governmental or other institutions, as I mentioned earlier in the first segment, that are out there. And I heard it said once that in order to bring about the change of an institution, you don't tear down the old one and build the new one. You go ahead and build the new one to make the old one obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts?
Yeah, and it's really interesting you bring that up, because I was just thinking about that this weekend with a particular client of mine that I'm actively consulting in. And we've done probably about 75% of the culture change work, and they've made huge strides in the space of a year, which is a pretty short amount of time for, as we know, for organizational change to take place. And we have been installing the new culture in lots of different ways. And I was just thinking about the vestiges of the old culture that are still popping up, and how, we're using the new culture to replace those old vestiges. And then it's some, and there are places I can think of too in this organization where we may need to dismantle some parts of the old culture that are hanging on. But yeah, you don't want to take down the old culture and then build a new one. You've got to start installing the new one first, or the change will be unsupportable for the business and also unsupportable for the people inside. It would be so massively stressful.
And
it wouldn't work.
Yeah. And yet, from a governmental standpoint, they don't do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The new guy or gal, because one of these days we will have a woman president, I guarantee you.
We will.
Again, we don't do it that way in government. We go in there, we've just been newly elected and sworn in, and now we're going to undo everything the last guy did. In other words, destroy that institution, and then we're going to put new stuff in. And in some administrations over the years, over the decades, you've had unbelievable turnover of key people, employees, if you will, whether they were cabinet members or whatever the position was. And I'm sitting here going, you're trying to make government more efficient. How is this more efficient? This doesn't make any sense. Because I've worked for radio stations where, thank goodness, most of the people that I've worked with stayed as long as I was there. And the longest job I ever held was 15 years. I'm kind of an anomaly in broadcasting, because when I was in school, they always told me, be prepared to move from station to station. Reminds me of that old Harry Chapin song, WOLD, where he's moving from one market to the next and doing rock and roll. And then he goes to the South to do a late night talk show. And then after 8 years, he's back in Boise, Idaho, talking to his ex. Hey, I could settle down if you take me back, kind of thing.
Right.
But. There are a lot of people that I have met who have jumped from station to station. And I know how frustrating it is to lose an employee, have to go through the interviewing process to find someone to replace this person, hopefully within the 2 weeks that they've given, if they didn't just up and leave. And hopefully they work out. I trained one gal for, I think, 2 months. I cut her loose on an 8-hour shift. We nearly had to credit every hour of that back to the brokered programmers. And I had to let her go and start the process all over again. I suppose that was on me too, but I thought she was ready, but she just got too nervous. And I said, I understand that, but can't do this any longer. So,
right.
What about all of that? And in terms of fostering a brilliant culture in one's business, but also just, in general, so that, we have a better place to live in general.
Yeah, I think, what you were saying about the government and someone comes in and they dismantle, right, what was there and replace with their own. And it's what we know from people who research change management is that doesn't work very well from observing it, right? But it's actually been proven in research that it doesn't work. And so in your business, and I can think of, businesses I've been, I've worked with or been aware of, in which a new leader did come in and do something similar to government, right? And want to put their own stamp on things and dismantle a bunch of processes, systems, people, departments, teams, and recreate it. And it almost always hurts the business. It almost always hurts the people. It just doesn't work well. Like you said, it's not efficient.
Yeah.
So, use good change management practices. Google it, and you'll find a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And really think about how you're introducing change. Really think about what you want the outcome and the goal to be of the change. Make that really clear. have a plan for communication, get people involved, get their input and feedback. And even these, all these things don't take a lot, they take a lot of time. They're not particularly exciting necessarily, but they're what's needed to make change stick and work. And I think, you know, at the beginning of our time together today, you mentioned change is a, you know, a bad word or something for a lot of people. And it's and the reason it is because it's usually mismanaged. So it's painful for them. Yeah. And when change is managed fairly well, where people can give input and feedback, they start to see that even though it might be stressful or hard at times, they get a lot out of it. And we're looking at larger societal issues or our own companies or, you know, educational institutions or whatever. There's an opportunity always to do change better than we do it.
Yeah. I know working for 15 years for a Christian radio station, we were made, it was made mandatory that we had to read this one particular book, short little book, cute little book, great message. And I read it and I went back to my boss and I said, okay, I read Who Moved the Cheese? But I said, I don't have a problem with whoever it was that moved the cheese. Just tell me that you moved it so I won't keep looking in the same place for it that it was the other day. You know, that's all I'm at. And maybe I'm asking too much, you know. You want to move it? Move it. I've got a coworker now that it doesn't matter if I tell him my move. He does not want it moved. He doesn't like the change, you know. Now, he's come around to a lot of changes that have happened over the last 11 years that I've worked here. But I changed a monitor once thinking this is a good thing because his vision is not that good anymore. And I thought this was a great thing. Turns out the size of the monitor was so large that it blocked the TV that he was monitoring for breaking news stories and the phone bank that allowed him to see when somebody was calling in. And I, of course, didn't take that into consideration. Well, of course, I changed things back. Mm-hmm. And we found another excellent use that he approved of for that larger monitor. So it worked out fine. But it's just, it's kind of funny that you run into people like that. It's just, it's very, very, very interesting. I want to remind our listeners that Cultural Brilliance, the DNA of Organizational Excellence, is available at culturalbrilliance.com. And to me, I think this would be a great addition, not just to your library, but to your workspace. And I would figure that in some instances, this probably would work pretty well. It could be translated down into to the family. Not that the family is a business, mind you, but there are certain organizational aspects to a family that exist even in a business, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You could absolutely apply this to family life, right? Because it's really about understanding how your family operates, deciding what changes you want to make, and designing a way to move forward and implementing the changes. So yeah, the same principles definitely apply to family. You could apply this to your work life. You could apply this to individual changes you're considering making. So there are, although the book focuses, as you said, on businesses, you can apply the ideas to a lot of different settings.
Claudia Raleigh, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. CEO of Cultural Brilliance, and of course, the book by the same name, and of course, the website by the same name, justadda.com, and we will be linked to your website. You know, if you should ever find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation, and we will turn the lights up to make it as brilliant as possible.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate being here.
Before we let you go, I have three final questions that I'd like to ask you, but I do want to remind our listeners that if you're listening to the radio broadcast, you better find the podcast at SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, as well as the radio show's page and the homepage of richarddugan.com, because we talked about a lot more, folks. We did indeed. And if you like what we're doing and you'd like to support the efforts that we are putting forth, we can use all the help that we can get in energetic as well as monetary fashion. PayPal account is linked up on our homepage as well as the missions page. If this is the first time you've listened to this broadcast and you'd like to know more about what it is that we do here, then you can go to that page, and then at the bottom there is that PayPal link. And we encourage you to go to my guest's website again, culturalbrilliance.com. My first of three questions to you as we wrap up our program is, who is Claudette Raleigh?
Who is Claudette Raleigh? Well, she's the author of Cultural Brilliance, and someone who's really, really passionate about making change in the world and leaving the world a better place.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve with the work that you're doing now?
I really want to raise awareness that you can change organizational culture, that there's a path for doing it, that there's a way of doing it, and that we can, through having better cultures in our businesses, really helps have a collective force for good that's going to help change our world for the better.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose has always been about helping people live their life purpose. It's been about helping organizations be in alignment with the best versions of who they can be, and really helping people bring their brilliance out into the world. My first book was called Embrace Your Brilliance, so which was for individuals, but it's really about capturing your own brilliance and letting that shine.
Again, Claudette, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program, and we look forward to having you back again to talk more about this, because there's certainly more to discuss, and even if we reiterate something, I think it's worth reiterating, because we need to have it continually, in some cases, hammered into our heads, that there are new ways of doing things. That's what we are looking for, those new ways of living, because just look around, the old ways aren't working. So we thank you so much for your input today. And again, thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
Thanks so much. Really happy to be here and look forward to next time.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Once again, brilliant, cultural brilliance, the DNA of organizational excellence. Until next time, love Talal.